All right, well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Robert Walls. I'm from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And as he said, this work is in collaboration with Eric London Miller and Brian Neil Levine, and it's on the forensic triage for mobile phones. So I want to begin with the scenario. So imagine the following scenario. We have this suspect, and then law enforcement is planning to execute a search warrant on that suspect's residence. Of course, their objective is to recover evidence related to a specific crime. And this evidence could be on electronic devices. So imagine they get there and they find a desktop, a couple of laptops, and multiple mobile phones. Thing is, all of these devices potentially contain evidence. And of course, law enforcement could just seize everything and send it back to the lab, but there are a few problems with this. First, it could take weeks or even months to examine all the devices because labs have limited resources and they're already overloaded. And perhaps more importantly, the evidence may become outdated or irrelevant, and police really need that information quickly to assist in their investigation. So before sending it off, law enforcement first begins with a process called forensic triage. So forensic triage is defined as the process of acquiring evidence quickly and on scene in a limited but accurate fashion. So triage is done before a full lab examination, but I want to stress that it doesn't preclude a full examination. In fact, triage can even help focus law enforcement's efforts on devices that are most likely to contain important evidence. Our work is focused on addressing the challenges of mobile phone forensic triage. In our efforts, we develop a system which we call Decode to quickly and accurately extract information from mobile phones that may be useful to law enforcement during an investigation. And by quickly, I mean less than 20 minutes per phone. So I'll cover Decode's operation in more detail later, but in a nutshell, we take the extracted raw image of a phone, then we give it to Decode, and out comes a set of information in the form of records. And this information could be address book entries or call logs or even SMS records or images. Okay. So Decode is unique in part because it extracts information directly from the raw bytes of the phone's internal storage. As such, it recovers more information than naive approaches, and it's able to operate without knowledge of the phone's file system or even specific record formats. This is because Decode was designed to advance a fundamental problem with phone triage, which is extracting information from new phone models that have never been previously examined by an investigator. So why do we choose phones and not something like desktops? Well, we do this for two reasons. One, desktops is a relatively older problem, and it's been explored. And the second reason is that phones are everywhere. Everyone has a cell phone. They're a major part of our daily lives. In fact, they effectively record our lives. We use them for making calls, sending text messages, checking email, playing games. It shouldn't surprise anyone in here when I say that they contain all sorts of information about us, including our habits and our social connections. What they also contain is evidence. Phones are carried before the crime, during the crime, and after the crime, and they may in fact contain direct evidence of the crime, as is the case with trophy photos. Even without direct evidence, they can still be used to help construct a timeline of events, compile a list of accomplices, or even to determine intent. While phones have all of this useful information, getting at this information is surprisingly hard. And it's hard because of the large number of manufacturers and phone models. This picture just shows a few of them. The diversity in the market means that there's a lot of proprietary operating systems and there's little documentation, which essentially leads to unknown formats. And this problem is especially pronounced for feature phones, i.e. non-smartphones. And most of you may not realize this, but feature phones are still the most common type of phone in use today. In fact, a recent survey found that 60% of Americans still use feature phones. So what triage options do law enforcement have now? Well, they essentially have two. One, they can browse through the phone, or they can buy a commercial tool. But neither of these techniques work as well as they should. So for option one, browsing, it has a number of significant drawbacks. First, it may not even be possible. A lot of phones have lock screens, so they can't even get at the phone's contents, or the screen could be damaged. Second, it actually modifies the phone. and this really violates forensic soundness. Further, the data on cell phones can be very, very volatile, so any information they overwrite could have been potentially useful. And finally, it misses important information. Browsing will only get the information that's available from the UI. This means it doesn't get information that's been deleted, it doesn't get timestamps or other meta information that you can find. Of course, a little better than browsing is commercial tools. Unfortunately, they also have a number of drawbacks. First off, they're cost prohibitive, and this means they're cost prohibitive both to law enforcement and they're cost prohibitive to the developers of the tools themselves. For in law enforcement, these tools are significantly more expensive than just browsing through the phone. It doesn't cost police any money to just pick up a phone and then start browsing through it. However, these tools that they buy could cost tens of thousands of dollars. And then for the developers, it costs them a lot of money too, because they have to invest significant time and money to handle each phone on the market. And even though they spend all this money, the developers still can't keep up with the market, and even the full set of tools out there doesn't support all phones. So it's time-consuming to ensure that the tool doesn't miss important information, even for the phones that it does support. And the way that they do that is the companies literally pay some guy to sit there and reverse engineer the formats day after day, hour after hour. Since neither of these two current options adequately address a lot of the core issues of phone triage, we set out to provide a third option. And the result of our efforts is our system, which we call Decode. Now, Decode is designed to quickly parse the raw storage of the phone in order to extract the useful information. For our purposes, we think of the raw storage as a stream of bytes with unknown format. In other words, we operate even without knowledge of the phone's file system. This allows us to get access to stored data, which often includes hidden information such as deleted data, timestamps, and metadata. It also allows us to run Decode on any phone that we can get the raw storage for. And finally, the system is quick. It takes less than 20 minutes to process most phones. I'd like to go over a quick toy example to make the problem and Decode's operation a bit more clear. So we start off with the raw storage. Our goal is to extract useful information from this storage. This figure only shows 832 bytes, but it really underestimates the problem. Feature phones can easily have hundreds of megabytes. And so the problem is basically like finding a needle in a haystack. Decode's first step is a filtering approach, which we call block hash filtering, which removes bytes that don't need to be parsed. They're shown in gray in this image. And I'll explain this a little more later. The filtering is intended to increase the speed of the system by reducing the search space for our next step, which is to use its inference component to identify possible information in the form of fields. So fields are the basic unit of information. They represent things such as phone numbers and timestamps. And in this case, Decode has identified a text field, a phone number, and a timestamp. Once Decode has identified the fields, it looks at those extracted fields and it attempts to join them into records. Records are just groups of semantically related fields. In this case, Decode interprets the combination of these three records, or excuse me, these three fields as a call log record, and it returns the following. So that previous example was a simple illustration of Decode's operation, and this figure shows kind of a high-level overview of the process. As I mentioned before, it takes the raw storage as input and outputs information found on the phone. It's also comprised of two primary components. The first is highlighted here, block hash filtering, and the second is inference. And I'll cover each of these in the upcoming slides. Finally, I want to point out that Decode itself doesn't pull the raw storage from the phone. For that, we do have to use an external tool. So the first component is block hash filtering. And the intuition behind this component is that phones will share information between different models, that there'll be a lot of data that will potentially be common, and this data isn't necessarily important to investigators. I'm talking about data such as operating system artifacts. These are things that investigators really don't want to spend their time looking at. And if we can remove this data, then we can reduce the time. So basically, if we can use the block hash filtering to remove half the storage, then we can roughly reduce the runtime of our system by half, which is a significant improvement. So the process of the process of block hash filtering works as following. We treat the raw storage as just a stream of bytes. Then we divide this stream into a series of overlapping blocks. We then hash each block and compare the hash to a library of known hashes and eliminate any blocks that match. I'm not going to cover the details of the hash library in this talk, but you can just think about it as a database containing hashes of other phones. I'd also like to point out that the basic block hash filtering technique is not necessarily novel, and it's very familiar to other works, including the rsync algorithm. This figure shows the effectiveness of block hash filtering as block size varies for about 25 feature phones. Ideally, we want this blue line to be as close to the top as possible. So we see at the left, when the block size is as small as 256 bytes, 73% of the data is filtered out on average for our phones. However, there's a trade-off between the hash library size and the block size. So a smaller block size means more blocks, and therefore we have a larger storage requirement for our hash library. So for the rest of our evaluation, we chose to use a larger block size of 1,024 bytes. And even at that larger block size, we're still able to filter 96% of the data on average. Okay. This figure provides a more detailed description of the filtered data. In this figure, we want the white bars, the top white bars, to be as small as possible, since this shows the percentage that needs to be parsed by our inference component. The bottom blue bars show blocks that are filtered for being constants. We call a block constant if it's just filled with a single byte of the same value, so all zeros or all Fs. In essence, this is the most naive filtering approach we can take, and so it sort of acts as a straw man for our approach. The black bars show blocks that are not constant, but they were filtered because some block was found on another phone of the same model. So the more black, the more that our block hash filtering improves over the naive approach. On average, half of the data was filtered because it matched another phone in the same model. The red bars show blocks that were filtered because they matched another phone in the library of a different model. It's important to note that there's overlap between the black and the red bars, but you can't really see it in this figure. However, these results suggest that most of the benefit of block hash filtering can be obtained by just comparing to a single phone of the same model. We can actually leverage this to further increase the speed of our system, since instead of having to compare against every phone in our library, we only have to compare it to a very small subset. So in summary, our block hash filter filters 69% of data on average. And there's a lot of overlap between the phones of the same model, which we can potentially leverage. So how about our inference component? Well, the component's used to extract fields and records from the data, so to get the information. And so you might be saying to yourself, well, that's simple. Why don't we just use regular expressions? Well, unfortunately, regular expressions won't work, because a byte sequence can have multiple possible interpretations. In fact, there are sequences and subsequences within that that can be both a phone number, a valid timestamp, and a valid piece of text. And when you consider cases such as in a text message, you may include someone's name and phone number, you obviously don't want decode to interpret that as an address book entry. So instead, we use machine learning techniques. Our inference component is based on the intuition that the semantic structure of records will be familiar across different phone models. By that, I mean that call logs are typically name, number, and timestamp, and that we'll probably see that across different phones. The specific encodings may change, and the ordering may be different, but the fields will be largely similar. So for the decode process, we first encode the formats using a set of probabilistic finite state machines. And these are very much like the standard state machines you know and love, except for each transition has a probability associated with it. So you could have two or three transitions from a state, and it'll have a certain probability of taking any of those three transitions. All right, we then use these state machines to parse the input data using Viterbi's algorithm. And I won't describe Viterbi's algorithm here because of time constraints. And finally, we sometimes receive false positives, and so we use a decision tree classifier to help eliminate the false positives that we do get. It's difficult for me to fully describe the state machines here, but hopefully this slide will give you a flavor of what they may look like. The top figure shows a possible state machine for a phone number. You see that above each transition there's a number, and this represents the probability of transitioning. This phone number state machine is a little bit boring because it always goes to the same states. All right? And in the field level state machines, that top phone number one, each state represents a specific byte value. The bottom figure shows the possible state machine for a call log record. You'll notice that this call log state machine is flexible in that it'll accept records that consist of name, number, and timestamp, but it'll also accept records that consist of just number and timestamp. So Viterbi actually has a group of these state machines representing all these rules that we've encoded. And it calculates the probability for each individual state machine on the data that we input. And it returns to us what it considers to be the most probable. So the next part of the inference component is the post-processing. And we want Decode's inference component to be able to recover as much information as possible. However, there's an inherent trade-off between the amount of information we can recover and the number of false positives. So as a final step in the inference process, Decode uses a decision tree classifier to eliminate false positives. Now, the reason we use this classifier instead of, say, encoding something into the state machine, because some things are just easier to encode using a decision tree than as a state machine. For example, if you want to measure the distance between two records in a file. So the decision tree classifier has the added benefit of reducing the complexity of our Viterbi algorithm. In order to actually evaluate the inference component, we went through a series of five steps. The first was actually to pick the phones that we were going to use. And this figure shows which set we decided to use for our evaluation. Our goal was to test Decode using feature phones from a variety of makes and models. So you'll see that we have phones from Nokia, Motorola, Samsung, and LG. And as I mentioned earlier, we chose only feature phones. And this is because they're particularly challenging to parse, and they're still the most common type of phone. You'll notice that we use multiple instances of each model, and this helps with the block hash filtering where we saw that comparing to another phone of the same model was very effective. Once we had our phones, we had to choose our target records. And for this, we chose to use address book and call log records, in part because they're common among phones, and also because they're potentially useful to law enforcement. After we submitted the camera ready, we actually extended our work to include SMS messages, and we also did it for images. So once we chose our record types, we had to go about creating the state machines. And to do this, we did it manually using a hex editor. We looked at all the phones that are denoted in that development set pointed to by the right arrow. We looked at those and we created the state machines by hand. Okay. And then once we had the state machines created, we had to actually acquire the raw storage for our evaluation. We had to get all the raw storage for our evaluation phones. And to do this, we used the commercial tool XRY to acquire the raw storage of the phone. This is actually one of those tools that cost tens of thousands of dollars. But fortunately, we got an academic discount to get it. Finally, we actually had to run Decode. And this figure shows the performance of Decode for call log records for both the development and evaluation set of phones. The bars represent the recall and precision of our inference component. The black bar is recall. And it's the fraction of all call log records we have successfully recovered from the phone. So if we have 100 call log records, we recover 99. We have 99% recall. The gray bar is precision, and it's the fraction of recovered records, including false positives, that are both valid and correctly parsed. Ideally, we want both the black and the gray bars to be as tall as possible. Essentially, the taller the black bar, the better decode is at actually finding the call log records. And the taller the gray bar, the better decode is at ignoring the data that looks like a call log, but actually is not. We don't show any bars for the Samsung T309 because it didn't actually contain any call logs. This is a really interesting case because it demonstrates the volatility of data on phones. When I initially acquired the raw storage for the phone, I found call logs. But later, when I was doing a more thorough analysis, those call logs had already been overwritten. So just by me using the phone, it caused those call logs to be overwritten. The left side of the figure shows the results for our development set. And as I mentioned earlier, this was the set that was used to manually create the state machines. And the right side shows the results for the evaluation set. Remember that the test set of phones were not examined prior to our evaluation. In other words, decode had not previously seen these phones. On average, we found that the evaluation phones had a recall of 97% and a precision of 72%. And after post-processing, we were able to increase that average precision to 80%. These results show that decode can perform even for previously unseen phones. It's important to reiterate that no extra work on decode was performed to get the results from the evaluation set. This is significant when you consider the time it would take to obtain the same results using methods that instrument executables or perform other machine and platform-dependent analysis. This figure shows decode's performance on address book records. It's similar in function to how we saw the call log records. Once again, we want the bars to be as tall as possible. However, you'll notice while recall is similar, the precision for address book entries is a little bit lower at 52%. And this is because address book entries tend to have slightly less recognizable structure than call logs. So whereas a call log is usually name, number, timestamp, address book is typically just name and number. And you see that a lot of things match ASCII text in the phones. Okay. So to summarize our inference evaluation, we recovered 93% of records on average for our address book records, and we did even better for our call logs. Then we found that with post-processing, we can increase our precision by 10 to 20%. Of course, there are a few limitations to our work. First, we assume that the raw storage can actually be acquired, and in reality, this is a difficult problem in and of itself. Second, system success is dependent on the quality of the finite state machines. And for this work, we manually reverse engineered the development phones to create the state machines. Of course, we'd like to do so manually, but this is a much more difficult, we'd like to do so automatically, but this is a much more difficult problem. Third, small fields, say fields less than 4 bytes, are difficult to encode properly. And this is because of their small size. We see a lot more false positives for the small fields than we do for the larger fields. Of course, the simple solution to this is to combine the small field and its adjacent fields in order to add more structure. Of course, there's been a lot of great work on reverse engineering and binary instrumentation, such as Polyglot, Tupney, and Dispatcher. And so the question is, why don't we use these approaches? Well, they do have merit, and they could potentially be used for a more thorough examination. However, these approaches won't work for phone triage, and this for a number of reasons. Put simply, they're too slow, too much work, and too difficult to implement for new phones in the triage scenario. And thus we come to our final slide. I want to give you the takeaway message is this. Phone triage is difficult because of the diversity of the market. It's hard to handle every device. What you don't want to do is you don't want to get into reverse engineering each new device on scene during triage. So we contribute a simple and effective way to handle new devices. Our techniques are based on leveraging the knowledge of a small set of phones to quickly and effectively recover information from mobile phones. I'd like to thank everybody for listening and ask you if you have any questions.
I take it then if you're an evildoer, you should get yourself a brand new, just put out phone to reduce the possibility of its contents being decoded. And I also noticed you had two phones there where you did very poorly. Those look like desirable brands for evildoers.
Yes, I mean, if you go out and grab a new phone, then it may be hard for us to find it. But then again, if it shares any commonalities with stuff we've done previously, then we should be able to handle that without any problems.
Yeah, Michael, Rick Farrow. So I was curious about the actual data acquisition. You know, I took my wife to the Sprint store to replace her own her old feature phone, and they go into this cabinet and they find the right cable, they plug it into a little box, very simple little box, and very quickly, you know, get the address book, any other information that you'd like transferred across. You know, it took 5 minutes. I don't think that these stores are spending 10 K on their boxes. So what's really involved in getting the data out of the flash?
Well, I can actually give you a kind of a funny story that happened last week. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you can take it to a store when you buy a new phone, they transfer contacts over.
A little scary, yeah.
Yeah, so one of my lab mates, his wife recently did that, but their system didn't work. It only transferred over 10 of the contacts. So right. He actually brought the phone to me, and I was able to recover the remaining 110 address book contacts that the Verizon store couldn't get. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even the people who have access to the source code, access to exactly how things are stored, even they're not getting everything.
So what you're saying then, the interfaces are not at all standard. You know, whatever they plug into it, it's some private protocol that allows them to talk to the flash storage.
Right. I presume they do something like that. I mean, I'm just speculating since I don't know exactly. But even the tool we use has, you know, a good 50 to 100 different cables to connect to any different phones.
Yeah, solid cables.
And the device itself is just essentially a USB hub. And it's just passing through to the machine. And they have any number of, like, different software plugins that they use to communicate with each device. And the way they created those was by paying a bunch of guys a lot of money to spend a lot of time trying to figure out just how to talk to each device. And part of what we're trying to do is to make at least some of the process a little bit simpler. Now, when it comes to actually retrieving the storage, well, I mean, that's a tough problem. That's not something that we've addressed in this paper. But when it comes to understanding the data, that's what
right.
we've been working on.
Right. OK, thanks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice job of the analysis.
Would it be fair to say that you're relying on the vendor commonalities? Because it looked like the two phones you did quite poorly were the ones you didn't have any training data for. Mm-hmm. Those were the two LG phones. So is it really you need a training sample from the same vendor? And then as time goes on, that quality is going to get worse as their protocols evolve.
Yeah, I believe that's a fair statement to make. And in fact, we didn't do this, but if you really wanted to even increase precision, you would use a different set of state machines, like vendor-specific state machines. And so you could use your Samsung state machines to process Samsung phones, and you probably get better results. Since we wanted to do a more fair evaluation, we used all of our state machines at the same time, which meant that occasionally we have, you know, for a Samsung phone to try and identify something as Nokia, you know, that would be an error. But then again, when we were processing LG phones, and I was very sad about this, but we had to put it in our development set, we took this LG phone, and we processed it, and it turns out that we only had to make one small change to our state machines in order to get all the LG stuff. So a phone model we'd never looked at before only took one change to really get all the data from it.